for the tape. But one more time, probably time number 30 or 31. This is Paul Rodell. And it's July 12th. We got a phone call coming in. And I'll pause.
This one, and then I'll fix the phone so it does.
Okay, so I was doing the intro.
You were introducing, and it is Friday the 12th of June.
Okay, no, July.
Thank you. Get back in the right month. But it is 1996.
It is 96. And we're sitting here in Alexandria, Virginia. This is not just Paul, but also Richard Jones. And he was in Vietnam from 1966 to 1969. And we'll get into that in a little bit. Teaching English in Da Nang and Hue, and also toward the end of his service, a regional director or team leader, and we'll get into that too as we go through the chronology. But right now, to start off, this is where I get to sit back and be quiet. I'll throw you the broad softball question, you know, the big powder puff thing, and actually most of this discussion should be more like a conversation rather than an interrogation. There's no point to saying, now, who was that? Don't you remember? You know,
right.
that kind of
right.
stuff.
Right.
But one thing that was not on the form was your own personal background, as you saw it. Starting off from when you were born, where you were raised, something about your parents, all of the social influences that created, that helped to create you, to bring you up to the time when, you know, 1966 is approaching, and your involvement in IBS.
I'll be glad to summarize that for you.
Yeah, and if I do chip in, hopefully it won't be with rude interruptions, but just to amplify and, you know, draw on something that you mentioned that I'm just curious about a little bit more.
Well, where you see me now is not too far from where I grew up, because I was born in Washington.
Hmm. The district?
Washington, D.C.
Huh.
Doctor's Hospital, somewhere in Northwest Washington. My parents were New Dealers after a fashion. They came here in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
They're both economists. My mother worked for the Bureau of Labor Statistics and then had three children and reluctantly gave up her career until about 30 years had passed, and then she went back to it again and wrote some economic history. My father worked for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, one of the New Deal agencies, and then the Federal Reserve at the Board of Governors. So we grew up in Northwest Washington on a street that had a member of Congress, Walter Judd from Minnesota, up the street, and a retired Marine colonel, and a few business people, a doctor, a lawyer, a private detective, a Finnish couple, some more economists, a pastor of First Baptist Church on 16th Street. Those were the only Southerners we knew. Ordway Street was not a street of Southerners. In fact, Ulysses S. Grant, the third or fourth, lived in a house on Ordway Street.
Well,
so I didn't know any Southerners until I married one.
Oh, well, did your parents come from the South originally?
No. My mother is from Seattle, Washington.
Oh, okay.
University of Washington and University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. My father's from Iowa, University of Iowa, and University of Chicago. So they're a University of Chicago school in some respects. At least he is a wholehearted Chicago school, free market.
Uh-huh.
Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman. Economist. She is more of a pro-consumer, pro-labor economist. They're both dead now, but we grew up talking about economics, talking about
social policies and
public life, believing that it was terrible that district residents couldn't vote. But they maintained a voting residence in Iowa, so that was okay. They voted at least in presidential elections, and she always voted Democrat, and he always voted Republican. So they canceled each other's vote, but they said, we will vote, even if we cancel each other's vote. They voted.
Good.
So I guess I got an image of citizenship. When a mother wasn't pursuing her career and was at home being a mother, she still got out and mixed it up in the neighborhood, contended with the D.C. Health Board to get a neighborhood private club pool to satisfy health department standards so it could be reopened, so there could be a pool for kids in the neighborhood to swim in. And that's the sort of people they were, and mm-hmm. they thought they should take their part in life of the community. My father did not go to war in the Second World War, but in the garage he had his air warden's white helmet that was left over from the days that he walked up and down the street and asked people to close their dark curtains, because Washington evidently participated in air raid protection procedures during the war. So we don't have a lot of war stories in my family.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow none of the immediate uncles or cousins did military service. Mm-hmm. Not pacifists, but we don't seek it. So it was Washington where I grew up, with some connections in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Finished high school at Webster Groves High School, St. Louis, Missouri, because that's where my father's job with the Federal Reserve took him.
Oh, okay.
At my junior year in high school.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I and both my brothers went to Oberlin College in Ohio. And at that stage, my life's goal, I thought, was to be a diplomat. I liked the striped pants that they wore. I thought treaties were better than gunboats. And I went to Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
To
so when was graduation from Oberlin? Graduated from
Oberlin 64.
Okay.
And 2 years at SAIS made it 66, when I was emerging with a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And my contemporaries were being drafted, and I was not an opponent of the war. I didn't think war was great, but this seemed like a necessary war. And so I was prepared to do my duty, and went around to the recruiters to see if they would like me. But somehow I had it in my head that I was officer material. I shouldn't just be a soldier. And the Army was giving aptitude tests. I think they're created by the same people that make all these college admissions tests, the Scholastic Aptitude, what are they?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Educational Testing Service in Princeton had one for Army potential officers. I didn't pass. There was a verbal part and there was a mechanical part. And I was great on the verbal and very poor on the mechanical. You have to show that you know what whether a bolt goes into a nut or a nut goes into a bolt. Didn't pass with the minimum that would guarantee me officer's candidate school.
Mm-hmm.
The Marine recruiter didn't like the way I spoke English. He wasn't sure that I could command men.
Mm.
And at that time I was negotiating with IVS also. And so in the...
How did you hear about IVS?
How did I hear about IVS? I cannot at this point recall. Did I see an ad? Did somebody tell me about them? It was probably John Summer.
Oh, really?
Who had been with IVS and then had gone to SAIS, whereas I went to SAIS, knew John Summer, and then investigated IVS as a possible place to serve. I suspect it was through John that I had heard
mm-hmm.
about IVS,
mm-hmm.
now that I think about it.
Nice fellow.
Wonderful. So, IVS was more efficient at recruiting than either the Army or the Marines, and that's why I went with IVS. I saw it as a chance to do my part in this war that seemed like a necessary, if you believe in containment, then sometimes you have to do something rough to make it happen. Strangely, I was at this...
So you actually requested Vietnam?
No.
Or did you know that IBS was there and just were hoping they'd assign you? It sounds to me like you were joining IVS to get to...
I think I offered myself to IVS, mm-hmm. knowing that they worked in Vietnam, and it just happened. They were increased in the numbers of volunteers they were deploying in Vietnam,
yes,
at a faster rate than in any other country.
So what if they had offered you another
If they had
country?
Said go to Laos, I'm sure I would have said yes.
But some other country? Out of the region.
I probably would have said yes, too.
You probably would have said yes also.
Probably.
Okay.
But Vietnam was in my mind.
Okay. Well, you were saying that you wanted to do your part, and, you know, if you believe
yeah.
in containment,
yeah.
therefore, the other areas wouldn't necessarily be containment-esque
right.
in a sense.
Well, Algeria, if IVS had anybody in Algeria at that point, didn't come up.
Uh-huh.
And Laos didn't come up, and... Cambodia, I think, had already been phased out.
I think by 65, if I give my chronology right.
So, somehow.
No, but I mean, if they had said, would you like to go to Peru?
Of
course, I'm asking you for things that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But it just seemed that, as if you knew that
Vietnam
it would
was
be
on,
Vietnam.
Was on my mind
okay.
and, from the beginning of my mm-hmm, conversations
mm-hmm.
With,
yeah.
with IVS. I remember being given my pin upon departure from Washington by Arthur Z. Gardner, who had sort of liked me as a recruit because I had had a summer job, one of my college summers, working for the State Department under Kenneth Landon, and he was a friend of Kenneth Landon's,
uh-huh.
and
mm-hmm.
so I remember he said, we expect great things from you in Vietnam.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So your motivation was sort of national service, in a sense.
Right. Since the military wouldn't take me on the terms I wanted them to take me,
yes.
I was happy to serve what I thought, to serve my country, and what I thought was the cause of rule of law and a better way economically than communism
mm-hmm.
through civilian economic development, nation building, all of the stuff that I had heard about that summer job in the State Department, where they were, this was the early years of the Kennedy administration, refining their doctrines about counterinsurgency and economic development.
Correct.
I had been part of the staff, the junior staff. I did the photocopying for a course where they brought together civilian and military people,
mm-hmm.
telling them, you're going to be a country team. We're not going to have the CIA doing its thing and U.S. Information doing its thing and the Army doing its thing. We're all going to be a country team under one ambassador. Well, I had seen how the Foreign Service Institute tried to inculcate that mode of working through a course
right.
that they taught called, I think, Counterinsurgency and Economic Development.
Mm-hmm.
So I was delighted to go to Vietnam, where this was supposedly the modus operandi of
mm-hmm.
the American
mm-hmm.
effort.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I would not be part of the government, still I had a preview of the thinking that was being applied in the U.S. government agencies at work in Vietnam.
Right. And did you know, you may not remember this might be a distinction that's too finite, did you know that IVS was basically contracted with USAID?
Yes, that was no secret. That was
no, but not that it was a secret, but were you aware of this so that you would in fact be part of the team, even if peripheral? That's going for the governmental service.
The truth is, IVS seemed to me, when it recruited me in the summer of 66, to have quite a bit of integrity of its own. I was impressed.
You
with
mean autonomy, or?
Well, I mean a coherent organization that set its own goals, that had its own personnel and its procedures and its payment and its review of what we did. So I felt myself part of a voluntary agency.
Okay.
I did not feel myself to be a junior AID or junior Foreign Service or junior military officer. I was quite pleased to be none of the above, but part of something that seemed to have some esprit that was cooperative with all of the above.
Correct.
But I took us to be, and later on as I tried to contribute to the leadership, I asserted that we were an independent, non-government, voluntary agency.
Okay, I just wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That did become quite an issue in the years
67,
68, within the IBS Vietnam.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, that led to those resignations. I mean, ultimately. I mean, that was one of the... I suppose it would be simplistic to say that was the only issue, but, you know, that was certainly the test, if anything. Now, let me see. We've got you raised.
And recruited.
And educated and buffed up and polished and... you've heard about the organization, as you say, probably through John Summer, and I'll throw in probably.
Right.
And it seems to meet the criteria that you want.
Oh, a second IVS person who came to study at SICE when I was there was Jay Parsons. So if it wasn't John Summer, it was Jay Parsons, who has lately been a UN Population Fund representative somewhere in Asia and then back in the U.S.
Somehow his name was familiar to me, I think through other people who I've spoken to. But I think he may be currently with an overseas address.
That's very possible.
And so we didn't send these yellow forms to folks who were overseas. John is actually in... I remember completely. He's in Africa right now.
John Summer?
No.
Or Jay Parsons?
Jay. I think he may be in... No, he may be in Africa. I don't know. I thought I was onto something and then got off of something.
Mr. John S. Parsons, Deputy Chief, UN Fund for Population Activities, 220 East 42nd Street, New York, New York.
Oh.
As of 1994.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the list that I got from IBS is a bit more current.
Anyway, it's one of
And I still may be wrong. He still may be in New York.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's one of these two...
He came, Jay Parsons, by the way, came to this nostalgic...
the 35th?
Yeah, and was one of the more articulate... people to speak about what IBS, what had been some of the peculiarities of IBS thinking. So, sort of anti-government sense. So I think Jay might be a useful person in your survey. He was, I remember his speaking up there.
Well, I'll perhaps look this over a bit. Let me not stop the tape.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the main reason for being here, not just silence while I paw through something.
Right.
And so the next step is, you've gotten this little pin, how about the training that you received from IBS before you actually got into your site?
I'd love to tell you about that. Except I want to back up. I remember I was going to say one more thing about my motivation.
Oh, yes,
you were asking about was I aware of IBS's relation to AID. But before that, I want to say my other personal motivation, in addition to citizenship, was a sense that this was also an opportunity to act out my Christian conviction of solidarity with my neighbors in hard times. I had been chewing up fallen limbs of trees from a storm that we had here in Washington 2 weeks ago.
Oh,
just a lot of down limbs that are still being chewed up, so there are chippers working out there.
Okay.
Now, I had counted myself out of the church for most of my college and graduate school years, and then found my way back, so that I was newly confirmed in the church as a 23-year-old in 1966, just on the eve of coming to Washington to go with IVS to Vietnam.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I know that I consciously thought, I'm going to be part of this war, I'm going to serve people, I believe that this is something that God would have me do.
Mm-hmm.
So, whereas there were those who were going away from the war, believing that that was what God would have them do, I was going to it, thinking that
to offer relief and succor during
relief, succor, and I believe there was such a thing as a just war, not a good war, but a just war,
okay.
A necessary war, and you couldn't always have them fought for you by hired hands. So, a sense of Christian service as well as a sense of American citizenship.
Correct.
Were simultaneous in my motivation, and it was important to me to be with other Christians during the time I was in training with IVS and serving in Vietnam. I was every Sunday in church and prayed, kept a diary. Those, no, you don't come in here, squirrel. Oh. Open window policy invites all sorts of creatures.
He's still looking in.
Is he? Yeah. Maybe he sees that peanut and thinks, gosh, if they have him that size.
Yeah, look at that metal.
Do not want him in here. I think maybe I'll close the window as a preemptive action and then fight the war afterwards.
Yeah? Either that or run out and buy screens.
It's 10 of. I think I better accelerate. You asked about the training.
Yeah.
IVS did two good things for people it was recruiting as English teachers in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
Good but brief.
Mm-hmm.
We had 1 week only, that must have been five business days, of phonetics and English teaching method taught by a member of the staff of the Sands Language School on New York Avenue, more or less
here in the district.
15th Street,
yeah.
Northwest. The instructor did not know Vietnamese, but he knew Chinese, and he had experience teaching English as a foreign language, and yep, he's still there. He gave us enough tricks of the trade about production of sounds, about the rules of the English language, about lesson plans, and as he said, it was his goal to make us walk into the first day of our classes and take charge of the class with confidence.
Well, that's important.
And as far as I'm concerned, he did that in 5 days.
Uh-huh,
so it was
uh-huh.
no doubt ludicrous in the eyes of educationists, but it was what we got, and
uh-huh.
I felt it was
and it worked.
Adequate with the help of textbooks and
sure,
some
sure.
supervision in Vietnam. The other training that we received immediately upon arrival in Vietnam was to be sent, as that photograph reminds me, up to Nha Trang
mm-hmm.
for 6 weeks of Vietnamese language training with an excellent teacher who was a North Vietnamese very crisp pronunciation, easy to hear and imitate, who drilled us using the textbooks for Vietnamese language learning that IVS had developed. So for 6 weeks we did pronunciation drills and pattern variant sentence formation things, enough so that I was confident enough to go out in the street and order a bowl of soup. And the best recollection I have was going into a little coffee shop and being warned against the water and everything. I thought I'd get a Coca-Cola. I thought that'd be safe to ask for, too. I knew I could say Coca, and this man was pulling my leg, I'm sure. He made me repeat it. What do you want, Coca? I said, the third time, Coca. And he went to the back room and came back carrying a little bowl with a goldfish swimming around it. And I said, here is your Coca. Because I had mispronounced, you see, and this was my fish that I'd been asking for. So he managed to convey to me that my pronunciation still had long ways to go. Even was only two syllables that I was trying to produce. But despite that, I left Nha Trang.
Did you eat the fish?
I didn't eat the fish.
Okay.
I understood it was a joke. And when I did leave Nha Trang, got my assignment for Da Nang, I went there with some confidence that I would be able to make myself understood on the street enough so that I wouldn't be totally helpless.
Yeah, yeah. Did you continue to pick up language?
I did. I got somebody to tutor me and kept it up for at least the first full year that I was there to try to increase my level, because what I was doing was English teaching in the classroom, speaking English all day long. I never did get to the level of fluency of some of my fellow volunteers whose work required them to work in Vietnamese all day, every day. But I could have conversations with people. I was never able to understand the radio, because that goes by too fast. And I was never able much to read the newspaper, because that was kind of high style. But for everyday pronunciation, people told me that my Vietnamese was good.
Okay. Where did you, where and with whom did you live when you were out teaching?
IVS rented a house, very comfortable, two and a half bedroom bungalow in the city of Da Nang, rented from this Vietnamese Air Force major.
Oh, that's right. You showed me a picture
and
of him.
And so
you two
I shared it with other, a varying number of other American, were they always American? Well, we had many visitors, but I guess it was always Americans who were living there full time. And we had a Vietnamese cook who really took care of us cooking and washing for us.
Okay. How were the students? What was your work like?
For the first 2 years, they were students in their last 3 years of high school.
Okay.
And at that point, it was still the French-based curriculum in which people had to choose a major foreign language and a secondary foreign language. One they studied for, maybe 5 years, and the other one they studied for maybe 3 years. They were to choose French or English, and the tide had shifted to English.
Oh, it had by then. Okay.
Oh, very much so.
Okay.
The French was getting left behind. People were choosing English as their first foreign language, and there was a lack of people to teach it because the English teachers got recruited to higher paying translator jobs working for U.S. contractors and the military and so on.
Sure.
So that's why IVS filled a manpower need of the Vietnamese schools. I found my students enthusiastic, bright, responsive, too many in a classroom, difficult really to help them very much with oral production of English because there were too many speakers to hear and correct at once. But we used all the tricks of one-at-a-time recitation and small groups and written work reinforcing oral work. And whereas other volunteers and people in other schools had terrible discipline problems. And the principal of my own school was killed while proctoring exams in another town. He ran a pretty tight ship at Phan Chu Trinh High School while he was alive. The atmosphere was a little tense. For example, students were supposed to sing the national anthem every morning standing in the courtyard of the school, mm-hmm. and they didn't like to sing. And I think it was their little protest, we don't like this government very much.
Mm-hmm.
1966, they were just 12 months away from an uprising in Hue by Buddhists that had been put down by the government forcefully, and a lot of them had Hue connections. And
12 months away, you mean 12 months previous?
It had happened before my arrival, but yes. People were still talking about it. Mm-hmm. So I think the students were, by their refusal to sing, were registering their divided loyalties. Some were gung-ho for the government, but many were resistant. We are sent.
You were talking about this.
It's the morning.
The singing and
flag
and
raising
how
ceremony.
Some wouldn't want to sing the national anthem. And
that's
But you know, one thing you said, and one thing I was thinking of, discipline problems. The principal getting killed while proctoring an exam. This is not my image of the average Asian student, who's attentive and deferential. What was going on here?
I think discipline was fairly good across the board, but there were undercurrents of various kinds. A lot of the students in Da Nang, in this government high school, had relatives on the other side.
Okay.
Everybody had relatives who had suffered, been displaced, or been killed in the course of the war. The war was weighing heavily on them. And especially after the Tet Offensive in 1968, when the government began to institute military training for students in their last year or last 2 years of high school, and kids had to turn out in military uniform to drill on, I don't remember, maybe Saturdays, there was a real chance for the students either to show they were patriotic gung-ho for the anti-communist government or to indicate their reluctance. And even before that program called on people to make it visible, I think forms of kind of passive resistance, malingering, murmuring, cutting class, not showing up, were ways for students, especially the boys, to demonstrate their distress at this future that was all too clear to them. If they stayed in school two more years, they would graduate into the army, they would go and fight, they might not last very long.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas here we might expect indiscipline because people are indisciplined at home or in their neighborhood or they don't see any future employment, there the war was a real demoralizing factor.
And how did the principal get killed? What was that all about?
His name was Ein. He was, a relative of some high-ranking officer in the Vietnamese army, as I recall. He was short of stature, and he liked to use the loudspeaker to compensate for any lack of being physically imposing. He employed a disciplinarian to discipline students with various kinds of punishments. And in the case of these exams, these were the standardized end of secondary school exams where you brought in outside examiners to administer to your students. So he was part of an outside team in Nha Trang, and the story that came back to us was that he had prevented a student from re-entering the examination room, or perhaps had confiscated an exam paper from somebody who was cheating, and the student's brother and friends met him in a dark alley and jumped him to punish him for doing this to their relative, and he fought, and they fought, and he got stabbed. So it was a non-war-related death.
No, 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 I understood that, but it doesn't fit my image of the normal deferential position that the teacher is held in Asian society.
I think that was an Asian society being worn thin at many places.
Mm-hmm.
The wisdom of the elders was challenged by communist ideology, by economic development ideology, by presence of a lot of foreigners, a lot of rewards for foreign culture and ways and contacts and employment and education that were carrying the day. So a lot of reason for confusion amongst young people as to who does provide the models worth following here. And a lot of reasons not to simply replicate what your father, your uncles, your mother, your aunts had done.
That's an interesting analysis. I follow it, and I think you may be right on the money. I think it's kind of a dreadful sort of example.
I had the distinct impression during those 3 years that I was seeing a society where the fabric was getting stretched and worn and torn apart in various places, but still hanging on. I think we'll have to
But we
pause
have to actually stop while we go to lunch.
Yep. Yep.
And now we can actually start up again.
Okay. And I'll just say what I was saying out in the corridor, that I'm delighted that part of your project is to assess impact in Vietnam as perceived or perceptible now, because in a society where things are coming apart, any foreign would-be developmental influence, it's like trying to make an impression on water or something else that's not very stable. It'll be quite remarkable to me if you find any traces at all of IVS influence.
Yeah, and we will be seeing people who, both Vietnamese and Lao, who are in the United States, who would have known IVSers over there to get their impressions at least of what was going on at the time. So that's a part of it, and then what continues to exist, if anything, is yet another part of it. So the non-American part is actually two parts. Is an A and a B, you know. What did they think then? Because there were some very poignant things that I can't remember his name, but he was a language, either language instructor or interpreter in Vietnam, said about why he worked with IVS volunteers in whatever capacity that was. And he said that as a Vietnamese, it pained him that he would have to, or that his country needed help from others. And that actually working with these foreigners almost seemed a little un-Vietnamese in some way. I forget how he said it. And yet his perception was of you folks was that by and large, you were all good people and came with honest motivations. You know, he was using some words to say that, well, maybe he had some problems with a few people, but on the whole, he was impressed with what he saw. And so that transcended his otherwise, as you know, polite, constantly polite, but yet standoffish Vietnamese nationalism of not wanting to appear to need help. You know, so I think that in and of itself is significant. It shows that, in fact, many Vietnamese did differentiate between the IVS volunteer and people in the other parts of the entire American presence.
Will it be any part of your plan to contact existing institutions, I mean surviving institutions, ongoing institutions, like a school, an agriculture station, that might have some institutional continuity and some personnel who might have survived the
communist
replacement personnel to ask them for their memories?
We've already got some names and addresses. And if you have any more, we'd be very appreciative of getting even more, because Mark will be doing this sometime in the winter.
I'm thinking of, now tell me if my memory's playing a trick on me. I think his name was Nguyen Ngoc Thi. That's not the name of the Air Vice Marshal, is it?
No.
Okay, Nguyen Ngoc Thi was an English teacher in Phan Chu Trinh High School, Da Nang. He worked with a couple of cycles of IVS volunteers.
Okay.
He was recruited by the IVS leadership to be sort of the English teacher on the staff of the high school who would overtly orient incoming IVS colleagues to how to behave and fit into the staff of that high school.
Okay.
And he fits the description that you just described of somebody very nationalist, a little put out and embarrassed at having so many American colleagues, and yet thought that the IVS people were more respectful of his country, his culture, his people in their predicament than some of the Navy people and others that he also worked for and had to cope with.
Sure, so, and even the AID folks who may not have had a sensitive background by being former IVS or former Peace Corps, of a temperament that, you know, didn't respect the foreigners, of which I knew some.
With a little work, I could dig out a list of names, but they would, current addresses I'm not good on, because I have corresponded with nobody. In fact, here's an embarrassing thing. When the influx of refugees to this country came in 1975, that included people that we and I had known and worked with, I was then back in the United States from a term of service as a missionary in South America, and I got a letter from the husband of an English teacher, been my colleague in Da Nang. They'd arrived at Long Beach, California, and were trying to make some contacts and headway and figure out how they were going to survive in the United States. And I didn't feel that I had anything I could offer them by way of a job or any advice or any assistance. And I never answered his letter. And I'm feeling bad about that at this point, and intermittently since then, when I remember the extraordinary hospitality that I was offered by people who were surviving with the dislocations of war. And I did help the resettlement of a couple of families in Dothan, Alabama, when this came in 1975, but the that letter from Long Beach, California just stayed on my desk. I couldn't think of anything useful to say, and I never wrote back to him. Mm. So I have not been one of the more active people in cultivating Vietnamese contacts with Vietnamese who've come to the United States, or with trying to revive or keep up contacts with Vietnamese who might have stayed that I had worked with. I'm imagining that a lot of the people that I taught with and that I taught
may be retired by now.
I'm imagining a lot of them were killed in military action or didn't survive prison camp, some of them. I've not tried to find out.
Yeah, yeah. But at least that one name, I mean, if he could be located, that'd be interesting.
Well, he'd have a lot to say.
Uh-huh.
And somebody who was in education, for IVS, would remember him.
Uh-huh.
And maybe would know about a he did translation work for the Navy, U.S. Navy in Da Nang, too,
uh-huh.
So he would have had many contacts to draw on at the time of the great emigration in 1975, and he's probably in this country, would be my guess.
That's true.
But some people do surprise you about leaving or not leaving. So I'm just writing down here his name and where he was in 1966 to 1969.
Okay, good.
In case that could be
of some use. Well, you never know. I thank you for this.
Yeah.
Let's get a little bit back to the story.
Okay.
Put this right here inside your. No, put it right here. And in the interest of reaching some sort of conclusion toward a 2 o'clock hour.
Right.
You mentioned that you were, when we were just having lunch, you mentioned that you were, this was in response to Ted's question, that you were in country during the Tet Offensive, and where you were. Now, of course, that came as a complete surprise. In retrospect, did you see anything that you would have could say in retrospect, oh, I should have realized this was going on, I didn't notice it.
Mm.
And then, tell me what happened during Tet Offensive to yourself and those people you observed.
I kept my field of vision narrowed, and since my first assignment was to teach in a school in Da Nang, my second assignment was to look after a handful of remaining volunteers in those five northern provinces. That's about all I took in. I did not attempt to pay attention to the tides of war. I didn't know where military units were. I didn't know where operations were going on. I listened to Armed Forces radio, but I didn't know the difference between a battalion and a squad. So I was just out of it as far as assessing military situations. I figured that was somebody else's responsibility, and I wasn't going to play soldier. And Da Nang, having the U.S. Marine headquarters on one side and the Air Force on the other side, and headquarters for 1st Corps of the Vietnamese Army on the third side, and the China Sea on the fourth side, you had the feeling that you were safe and life would go on and you didn't need to pay attention to the war as you would in some other more vulnerable, contested areas of the country. I did, however, have this responsibility for supervising other volunteers, and I felt bad in retrospect that I let a new group of volunteers go and accept assignments in Hue, who then got themselves captured after the first couple weeks they were in residence.
This is the French-Canadian
Yes.
and
And Marge Nelson, I guess she was not with IBS, I think.
Johnson, right.
Was it Johnson? Nelson is what comes to my mind. I have to go back to my physician. Seems to me Quaker, maybe. The International Organization of the Quakers sponsored her work. At any rate, that...
American Friends Service?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. At any rate, those folks were in Hue Tet 68, brand new, and that was a terrible thing to do to somebody
new
in the country.
Well,
but
only if you had done it knowing
more,
that we're going to be...
people who thought they were more in the know than I also miscalculated.
Oh, sure.
For those of us living in Da Nang, we just stayed put in our fortified city and heard reports over the radio about everything in the country's overrun and fighting here and fighting there. And it was Hue that was of the greatest concern because people...
So you yourself really didn't get see any of the action?
I stayed put.
Yeah.
I stayed put, and I was unable to go do anything for any of my volunteers who were in
but
the adjacent
no
provinces.
Encircled your area,
no,
really?
Well, yes, there was in some neighborhoods of Da Nang for the first day, and then it was repulsed, and Da Nang remained in government hands the whole time. So unlike other cities, there weren't major sectors overrun, and it didn't change life that much in Da Nang. People could stay on the side they had chosen to be on. IVS, after we could communicate again and meet again, did take some people out of one or two provinces. I think we took people out of Hoi An in Quang Nam province and out of Quang Ngai City in Quang Ngai province following Tet 68. And the people from Hue all were gone and stayed gone, or were captured and stayed captured, so there was no IBS presence for several months in Hue until the University of Hue reopened, and they needed some help in restaffing.
And that's
and
when,
that's
IBS
when I went up there myself to be the first IBS volunteer returning
to
Hue.
Then
some others came after me. And a marvelous person who was at that 93 reunion at Harper's Ferry, would be wonderful for you all to interview, is the man who reopened the University of Hue, Lay Tan Min Cho, who after 75 came to this country and was, what was his position, a dean, some kind of a dean at Notre Dame University until his retirement within the last couple of years.
So folks at Notre Dame might know where he's located.
He is in Notre Dame still.
Oh.
He's a great football fan. He's staying put there.
Oh.
And if this thing had addresses of people in attendance, which it should have had, it would be in here.
Oh, it does look like that there is.
Here he is, Lay Tan Min Cho, South Bend, Indiana.
Okay.
He would be a wonderful person for you to talk to.
Okay, excellent. Because I will be going into Indiana.
I'd love for you to talk to him.
Yeah, excellent. I will
leave
that page open.
I was very impressed with his valor, his candor, his flexibility in coaxing faculty to return and negotiating with military people to give the cooperation and support the university needed to get itself up and running again. He had a vision that I think turned out to be impossible of making the University of Hue a center for feasibility studies for economic development in the region of central Vietnam. He really had a hope and a belief that having survived the Tet Offensive, the government was going to pull itself together and there was going to be a bright economic future for Vietnam post-war, and he wanted the University of Hue to be part of that. Didn't happen.
Yeah,
it was with that kind of vision that he reopened the place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's what was driving him. Yeah.
He quoted to me that faith is the assurance of things unseen. that he lives that. Lived it then and
still is.
Lives it now.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I will try to give him a call when I get back to Georgia.
You'll find him very gracious. Just don't try to get him on a football day.
Well, this will be during the summer.
You'll be going there in summer.
Yeah, yeah. There won't be any conflict. This is earlier, I think, before even the tape went on. There was a quick reference to the fact that you became a team leader. Now, help me out with the dates here. You came in 66. What month in 66 was it that
late,
you arrived?
It was November.
November of 66, okay. That's how we get into 69.
That's right.
So then you were in Da Nang from November until approximately when? Until
I think
until
the language
the
training in Nha Trang must have lasted through Christmas, so maybe it was January.
That you actually came into Da Nang.
67 in Da Nang, and
okay.
was there on through that year, through
mm-hmm.
the Tet Offensive.
Through the Tet, yeah.
And until Hue University reopened in late 68.
Okay. And then until
I served in Hue for one academic year.
Until the bottom of the next year, 69,
that's
about
correct.
June or so.
That's correct.
Okay. So when was it that you actually had the position of team leader? Because that seems to come not coinciding with these physical moves of yourself.
No.
But while you were in Da Nang.
That's right. I was asked to serve as team leader when Don Ronk resigned
mm-hmm.
along with Don Luce,
mm-hmm.
whenever that was in 67.
Okay.
So I began from that point and served through 68,
mm-hmm.
Was replaced. Somebody else took on that responsibility. So the last 6 months I was there, I was not the team leader, but was simply an English teaching volunteer again.
Up in Hue.
Yeah.
So what was the time then that you were a team leader?
Must have been from mid 67
mm-hmm.
until end of 68. That's my best.
Okay.
My best
All
guess.
Right. So about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. About the resignations, were you involved in any of the discussions? Because I think there was probably a well-discussed topic among volunteers. Am I right in making that assumption?
I think there were some people who frequented the Saigon office more and
mm-hmm.
maybe were involved in discussions. When I heard about it, though, it came as a surprise.
Oh, okay. All right.
And Don Ronk
mm-hmm.
explained, in explaining the decision of himself or the others who resigned, that they didn't want to demoralize everybody and they didn't want to unduly influence other IVS members, and especially those who had newly arrived in the country. They didn't
that was
want
your,
to...
You fell into that category?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would
okay.
have at that point been somebody who had been there less than 6 months. And,
all right. Okay.
So
that's one of the reasons why I was going through the chronology again, just to locate you within this sequence of
yeah.
events.
Yeah.
Your own events and these external things,
right.
too. Yeah.
So I took their point. I understood what they were protesting against,
mm-hmm.
but I did not feel any need to join them. I think a few people did want to, a few IVS volunteers did want to sign on as co-resigners when they heard about the leadership resigning because they were sufficiently fed up with the amount of destruction that they saw
uh-huh.
Undoing the work
that they were trying,
they
to,
were
do.
Trying to do of
yeah.
a constructive nature. I did not feel motivated to make that protest. I continued to believe in 1967 that there was something constructive
mm-hmm.
to be done. And I had come to do it, and I wanted to continue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. So then you basically took over Don Ronk's turf.
Correct.
For
That's
that
right.
for that year and a
That's
half.
That's right.
Okay. I just wanted to locate all of these
oh.
these in. had your experiences going through the Tet Offensive, seeing the rebuilding after, et cetera, and trying, people trying to build up, might that have, if those resignations had occurred closer to the end of your term of service, might that have made any difference if you had wanted to do a sign-on?
Well, I did, as those 2 years went on into the third year, become less hopeful that the outcome of the war was going to be a constructive one.
Yeah.
I could see more clearly the costs. I could see less clearly any cohesion among those that wanted to build a non-communist alternative. I just kept seeing fragmentation and weakness. And the escalation of military activity increasingly raised the question, is it worth this price? Is it worth this price? But even at the time I left, which was, I guess, May, or maybe it was June of 69, I was only skeptical. I was not a converted opponent of the South Vietnamese government and the American alliance. I was anxious to see negotiated peace. I wanted negotiations to go faster. I thought that Richard Nixon would be good news because he had the anti-communist credentials that would allow him to make peace, whereas somebody else maybe couldn't make peace. And I was disappointed when he instead became converted to the view that we can win.
Yeah.
That's what I recall about my convictions of the war.
At that time. Yeah. And so then in coming home, you made a decision to enter the place where you are now.
That is true. I got the idea of going into the ministry while I was in Da Nang and Hue.
Is that so? Okay.
What had never occurred to me before.
What was it about that experience?
Partly it was feeling so sad for those fellow Americans around me who lived for TGIF. Who were just going around in circles Monday through Friday until the happy hour, who were living for the bonuses and the high salaries and the air conditioning, but were going through a charade. They didn't believe in their jobs. They didn't